Hello, everybody. The following is a recorded discussion for the Daily Maxims and More for January 2nd, 2011. In the beginning, we talked about a little bit about Michael Badnarik's book, Good to Be King, and a couple paragraphs from that. And then we got to our Maxims of the Day, which were over agreements. Hope you enjoy.
Following is Michael Badnarik's book, Good to Be King.
Okay.
One purpose of the Constitution was to create a government more powerful than the one outlined by the Articles of the Confederation, but not so powerful that it could interfere in the details of your personal life. The Constitution establishes a separation of powers, dividing our government into three distinct branches to prevent any single branch from exercising. I'm checking to see if somebody else just checked in.
Yes, hello? I did. This is Joe.
Joe Hoagland on the phone?
Yes.
Okay. We had just started to read the Maxims. Do you have them up on your screen?
Yes, sir.
I'm looking at the foreword following. It's from
Eric's
book. We just finished the first two sentences.
Okay.
This is one of the many checks and balances deliberately built into the system. The Constitution places explicit limitations on the powers of government. And that's a good choice of words there, explicit. Now, I've got to figure out how to make my window scroll. Excuse me. Thomas Jefferson reportedly wrote, "Let no more be said about confidence in men, but rather bind them down from mischief with the chains of the Constitution." Although some sections of the Constitution grant the government power and privileges, other sections explicitly prohibit the government from doing certain things. The Constitution is, in part, a negative authority, exemplified by the phrase, "Congress shall make no law." Now, somebody's going to make out a joke out of that. It's going to end up being, "Congress shall make no laws." Plural. Anyway. That's interesting. The explicit limitations. Good to be king. Now, why do you think he chose the word king in the title of the book?
People are sovereign.
That is correct. They have the lawmaking power. And they have delegated it in small amounts to servants or stewards who are employees or bureaucrats in the government. In particular, the lawmaking goes to their representatives, whom they have a contract with. That contract is composed of the offer being the election results and the acceptance being the taking of the oath of office by the representative. At that point, they are lawfully bound to do the duties they have been assigned in these limited powers from the Constitution. Now, the following maxims are what we're discussing today, January 3rd, and we're going to talk about agreements and fraud. An agreement induced by fraud cannot stand. That means it has no, they cannot use a fraudulent contract to use the powers of the court to compel performance. Now, are those words familiar to you?
Power of court is familiar. The concept of power of the court is familiar. What is not familiar to me is the sentence itself. An agreement induced by fraud cannot stand.
Well, a stand is a legal word that says you can't even stand before the bar.
Oh.
Okay? You cannot tie up this court making decisions about a fraudulent contract as to compelling performance.
But the IRS still drags people in the court, and it's all because the people are claiming there was a fraud involved, and they're claiming there wasn't.
Well, it depends on whether you have sufficient documentation to show that there was. Okay? If you failed to get a public record, like certain filed, like revocations of power of attorney at the county court, at the county clerk's office, which they in turn failed to respond and rebut, and the grant and the grace period elapsed, and therefore they acquiesced, and you were able to get a default judgment, it really, it's like, well, the fraud was the reason why they couldn't say anything.
I see.
But really what gives you your power to defend yourself is the fact that they failed to speak, not the fact that it was a fraudulent contract. If they were honest people, the fraud would have been announced, noted, and the contract's done away with. Did I go too fast?
No. Very clear. Thank you.
So it's your papers that are protecting you, that where you, they were compelled by virtue of not being able to tell a lie, they remain silent. And their failing to speak gave you a default judgment, nihil dicit. It would, you see, nihil dicit judgments hold up even if the contract wasn't fraudulent. Is that going too fast for you?
No, but just tell me how to spell that word.
Which one? Which word?
Nihil dicit.
It's two words.
Oh.
Two Latin words. N-I-H-I-L.
Mm-hmm.
D-I-C-I-T.
Okay.
It's nothing words. No word. Failed to speak. See, they can even ask for more time. That's where they can speak up and say, I need 3 more days. Now, it would be unreasonable for them to say, I need 30 more years. Okay, the next one. Those things which are impossible to be given, which are not in the nature of things, are regarded as no part of an agreement. Now, this is like one of the other maxims. If it's impossible, and people generally agree that, well, it's just wrong, you know, that you've got to stand with your feet on the ground and reach 12 feet with your hands. Otherwise, you know, we're not going to give it to you. Well, that's a requirement. Now, let's just review something that I was thinking about on the first one. In every contract, there is mutual agreement. And it is made up of duties and rights. Okay? Now, over in the common law, with that thing, we've got rights and remedies. Now, we have here in contract law, duties and rights. And rights and duties kind of pair off. Duty for party A is probably some sort of right to party B. And compelled performance has to do with compelling that the duty be performed. because the other person has a right to it. And so the court is acting on behalf of the party with the rights when they compel the other party to perform. But anything that's impossible just will not be given any notice. They really will probably do something like sever it from the contract and say, that's not even in the contract anymore. It's over. Nothing can be affected by an agreement that there shall be no accountability for fraud. Now, this is pretty interesting. I had not really thought of this one. But people get to thinking that, well, we're going to sit here and we can agree to things. You and I together as sovereigns. And we're the top of the rung on the ladder, and we can do what we want to do. So, here's what we're going to do. We're going to agree that even if fraud is discovered later, that it won't be considered a fraud. This says, nothing can be affected by an agreement that there shall be no accountability for fraud.
Very good.
Now you understand it?
Yes.
You can't put that sentence in there that I just mentioned. There's no way that you can keep fraud from coming to the surface and being and remedy applied. By special agreement, things are allowed which are not otherwise permitted. Now, this is sort of like non-disclosure agreements. Freedom of speech says, yeah, the freedom of speech. But these folks went out to Utah and they signed a secrecy agreement so that they can't tell us what they did. And that's why we can't learn what they did until we put ourselves on the line in some way. So, nothing can... special agreement then gets into those areas. Now, you cannot agree to commit a crime. But this has to do with your acquiescing of rights. And that's why the statement, reserving all rights, means something to you every time you speak. You can say, now you got to understand I'm reserving all my rights here so that you don't have to explicitly enumerate them. And so, in that case, some of these special agreement things they're talking about here would be non-existent, so to speak. The express agreement of the parties overcomes or prevails against the law because the agreement of the parties makes the law of the contract. Now, this is an interesting opportunity to teach. I told you that the most significant law to the sovereign is the law of contract.
Yes.
That has nothing to do with the exact explicit duties that are described in a contract, or the explicit rights described in a contract. It has to do whether, if there's a contract with duties and rights defined, and someone is breached, then the law of contracts can compel performance. However, this says, they cannot, they can't really come inside with the law to monkey with the things you're dealing with and agreeing to. That's why I think there's things out here where they keep using the phrase consenting adults. Because they're getting off into making certain things crimes, and then they say, but that's not a crime for consenting adults. So it's. I don't think if you're living a common law life, that gets to be a real problem. because the common law is always protecting your property and so on. Now, bailments are a special provision which shows up in the Hebrew law quite frequently, and that's where I just have to think of something in the Arab law that kind of fits in there. The it's where it's yours, and you've given it to someone to just hold for you. It's not really theirs for their purposes, although you can give somebody a car in bailment, and they drive it and take care of it and everything else, but it's your car. But they are bailees. Now, as bailees, they've got to treat your property with proper regard and respect. Okay, now the Arab law I was thinking about was, they told me a story there that if I was in Saudi Arabia and my son was with me, and I turned to my friend Mohammed al-Bosri and I said, Mohammed, I must run over to the factory over here and take care of something. I'll be gone 45 minutes. Do you mind taking care of Scott for a moment till I get back? And he would say, no, I'll watch him. Thank you. Now, if I got involved in an accident and died, he would be obligated to take care of Scott for the rest of Scott's minor life until he was an adult. That's the Saudi way.
Wow.
And it's sort of the same way with the old folks. You're obligated to take care of your old folks and your young folks, and you could bring a sojourner into the midst and he gets the same treatment. Now that's a carryover from Hebrew law. You'll find that in the Bible. Any questions about any of these?
No, not yet.
Well, I think that's the last one, isn't it?
Yes, sir.
I had an indirect question. But what is the proper way of writing a signature when you want to reserve your rights? Do you use brackets or you just write the words reserved or reserving all rights?
Well, it's typically I would write it above my signature, not below.
Above, okay.
Typically it would be reserving all my rights, or, you know.
Okay.
So I specify whose rights they are, and there's no it just so it's within the body of the document, just ahead of your signature. Now they will not let you sign a check that way. We started signing them that way back in the mid early 90s, and all of a sudden the bank said, "That's enough." Because it was really bad news for them. They had to have us acquiescing.
Oh, I see.
Now, what's that? Chuck is not on. I don't know the exact problem, but you couldn't reserve your rights and sign a check. Now, there are subtle ways to go around that, but it takes a while to exercise, and it may prove, and given the conditions, the facts and circumstances, it may not be allowed. Are you back on, Chuck? Somebody have their speaker on? Hello? Hello. Well, it went away finally.
Yep.
Is there someone here that we didn't know about?
That was...
Must have been.
That was what?
I say they must have been on here and you didn't know about them because they left.
Well, they're back.
No, now we got it back.
We've got the echo again. Can we turn the recording off so that we can get you?